Good morning, committee members. Welcome to our first interim transportation committee. It's great to see all of you again after a time away. It's great to come back to the building and get back to work, so to speak. So we work on some of the things that we were successful in the session, and we look to the future in our next session in January of 2003. I think all of you have got an agenda for today's meeting in front of you, and we're going to follow that fairly closely. And the first thing that we have on the agenda is the committee rule adoption. Are there any comments or questions regarding the committee rules? Can I have a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Representative Brown.
I move that the committee rules be adopted as submitted to us.
Representative Brown has moved that committee rules be adopted as proposed. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Easy. Let's just get right into the agenda then. And I think we've got a pretty cool one today and I'd like to a lot of information to cover. So we'll start with our informational meeting on Transportation Investment Act update, House Bill 2142. Bruce Warner, you can bring anyone that you want to bring, or if you want to
bring that here,
do it yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Warner, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. With me also to my right here and your left is Matt Garrett, who is our chief of staff, who I'm going to ask to actually give you the update and on the implementation of House Bill 2142. And there should be a memo in front of you now from me to the committee dated November 29, 2001, which we'll use as the instrument to brief you this morning, and Matt will walk through that in a moment. It is a pleasure, I want to say, to be here and to let you know the work that we've done to date on implementation of the Oregon Transportation Investment Act. But before I turn it over to Mr. Garrett to walk through the memo and our work to date, I do want to take another opportunity to thank the chair, the committee members, the legislature, the governor's office, our cities and counties, and our stakeholders, such as the American Automobile Association with Oregon and Idaho, and the Oregon Trucking Association, and the Oregon Highway Users Alliance, for working hard to make this a reality and allowing us the opportunity to demonstrate that we can deliver some transportation improvements for the state of Oregon. As you know, this funding package is a start. It does not solve all of our needs, but it will allow us to address many critical preservation and modernization needs throughout the state. And all of us appreciate the vote of confidence that you've given us to on allowing us to invest these dollars in the state of Oregon. The department and I are committed to assuring the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, as you'll find out we lovingly call it now OTIA, is implemented successfully, and I believe that you will find this morning that we are off to a great start and that significant progress has been made on implementation to that end. If acceptable to committee, I'd like to now turn it over to Mr. Garrett to actually walk through the memo and give you the real update.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Matthew Garrett. I am the Chief of Staff at ODOT, and I have the privilege to walk through some of the key junctures that related to House Bill 2142 or the Oregon Transportation Investment Act that have taken place since June 28th when Governor Kitzhaber signed the bill. You'll recall that the bill provides $400 million for preservation, bridge, and modernization projects by bonding new revenue. The new revenue comes from three sources. Obviously, House Bill 2142, which increased the title fees for automobiles and trucks and heavy trailers. Additional revenue stream came from House Bill 2139, which was the DMV fee increase, and what that did was to try to cover the transaction cost and the trust fund subsidy for those transactions that take place at DMV. And finally, a third bill made up the trilogy, which was House Bill 3068, which was a utility fee. Altogether, those bills generated about $71.2 million per biennium to pay for the bond and the interest. Now, I'd like to speak to some of the charges and commitments that that come from the bill directly. The bill requires the commission to use these bond proceeds to fund the three categories of projects I mentioned. And it actually specifies the type of projects that should be selected. And I have bullets, highways that need increased lane capacity, and I'm going to refer to them as modernization projects. Highways and bridges that have weight limitations, state and local bridges, interchanges on multi-lane highways, and then pavement preservation on district-level highways. The commission is charged with two major mandates here, I see. One is to make sure that we select these projects by February 1, 2002. The time frame that actually was the trigger for a lot of the activities you'll see, and it's placed us at a very fast pace, but I think it's a pace that everyone has got on board, and we seem to be running fairly well, fairly comfortably, and the feedback is that so far so good. The second major mandate of the commission is to ensure that the projects are distributed equitably throughout the strait. The last attachment I have reflects this this project pattern spread throughout the states, and I'll get to that later in the presentation as we get to the portion when we speak to the project list. But that gives you a depiction of where the projects that are good candidates for approval are landing throughout the state. Once again, a quick pace, the timelines here. We needed a forum to engage a comprehensive engagement on these on this issue related to criteria, related to allocation, and more specifically related to project selection and vetting. And we chose, our commission chose to use the Area Commissions on Transportation as the host, as the forum to engage in this conversation. It was crystal clear from our commissioners that this has to be a very aggressive engagement. It has to be comprehensive. And it has to be transparent. And they charge the area commission chairs and in those areas that don't have acts, those bodies that form advisory groups on transportation, they do exist, that you will engage and you will ask folks to come and sit around the table, folks from the regional community solutions teams, folks from the environmental community, those folks that have interest in transportation. Anyone and everyone who wants to speak to any issue related to House Bill 2142, you will have a seat for them at the table. And thus, the ACTS became, the forum and the host for these conversations. It's been robust, it's been healthy, and it's been working for all intents and purposes. Just going back to Catalyst, once again, is that February 1, 2002 time frame. We went to our commission and scheduled a timeline or with a schedule and a timeline to try to meet that mandate. Literally, we took that February 1 date and worked backwards to the first week in July, and we plotted time frames where we would engage in conversations on criteria, on allocation, and then on project selections when the ACTS would bring forth their recommendations. And Attachment A of your package shows the timeline from July 11th to April, but for all intents and purposes, I'm going to concentrate on that July 11th timeframe through January 16th. January 16th is the date that we expect our commission to make to give their final approval to the OTIA projects. This aggressive outreach is to take place in a disciplined time, and we allotted an August 10th through a December 12th timeframe for people to engage. We thought that allowed enough time to get the information from the ACTS in front of people. They could vet these projects, share whatever concerns they had, share the projects they wanted promoted. What we were trying to do is bring a disciplined conversation regarding these projects. We had the opportunity to learn a couple lessons a couple years ago. We found out that without constraints, you have people coming around at different points and at different forums sharing their thoughts and opinions on projects. What we've tried to do here is once again use the ACT as the hub, bring people there, and have a time frame for comment. That was the first key action. The second key action related to 2142 was the drafting of the criteria. Now within the bill, there were five points or sets of criteria that the legislature forwarded on to us. Section 3 of the bill allowed us to augment that, so to speak, to try to bring a little more definition, a little more clarity to the types of projects that would compete for OTIA funds. This, again, was extremely transparent and aggressive as we engaged our local government partners. The local official advisory committee made up of elected officials and local government staff. We had the opportunity to engage a group known as the STIP Stakeholder Group. It was a committee or task force led by OTC Commissioner Stuart Foster, who was looking at the STIP process itself. They thought it such an important issue that they actually stood down for two meetings and focused in on the criteria specific to how OTIA projects would make their way as viable candidates, since that was somewhat of a tangential or a relationship to the STIP and how projects make their way onto the STIP. Extensive work. The STIP stakeholder group is a broad-based or was a broad-based group of folks representing all aspects and components of transportation and interests that make comment on transportation. And let me tell you, their work was just was outstanding, and for all intents and purposes provided the foundation from where we jumped off as ODOT staff in forwarding criteria to our commission. So once again, we were extremely aggressive, extremely comprehensive in our engagement specific to the criteria. What that led to was what I'll refer to as Attachment B now. This is a listing of the criteria. It's a matrix. You can see it's broken into the three categories of modernization, pavement preservation, and bridge. Those are the three type projects. Specifically, we tried to make this simple. Bottom line, we wanted filters to make sure we were going to move projects that could be delivered quickly, projects that weren't encumbered with issues, be they environmental, be they land use, be they any other type issue that would hold back a project from being delivered. As Director Warner indicated, this is the gravity of this bill is not lost on anyone at ODOT. We want to deliver this bill. It's important to us. It's important to our local government partners as well. And we want to make sure we produce the best projects, which will show that the investment that the 2001 legislature made is reaping dividends, i.e. you're seeing projects delivered, and hopefully you're seeing those projects delivered when you come back for the 2003 session. But a quick walk through the criteria here shows we cut it up into two sections here. One, eligibility. Once again, this was the filter we tried to use to thin the herd. You will see that we have the language that was in the bill, the criteria that you placed in the bill, as well as some criteria that was forwarded by the various groups. As a matter of fact, I think we had somewhere in the order of 26 sets of comments specific to criteria, and they were across the board. I will just quickly touch on some because you'll see they ripple through all the three categories, but consistency with the various comprehensive plans, the transportation plans. Once again, trying to make sure we're identifying those projects that have been vetted to some extent, known projects that could move. The second issue dealt with the consistency with our policy 1G1 of our Oregon Highway Plan. That's specific to modernization. We have specific protocols we need to follow. We want to make sure that when in picking those projects, we can have the appropriate language and the appropriate effort that shows that this is indeed the appropriate fix for the transportation problem we're trying to address. Finally, what I think is the major criteria is projects that achieve project readiness. Are these things ready to go? We have some parameters placed on us with the bonding that once we issue bonds for projects, we have 3 years to complete those projects. Again, project readiness is that filter that thins the herds, making sure we get good projects that we can deliver in those timeframes, and we're confident of that. That was a major point. Moving down in the modernization to the prioritizing projects, this helps. Once we identify the universe of projects that can compete, these prioritizing projects will help float those projects that the legislature deemed appropriate, as well as some of the additional comments we put in here, move those projects higher on the list and they become the viable candidates that you see today. Once again, specific to modernization, you have the interchange projects on a multi-lane highway that promote safety. Our highway plan, the land use component of it, the ability to enhance freight mobility. We had the freight advisory committee engage and indicate that when you do look at these type projects, make sure we're not encumbering the movement of freight. That's very important, and they engaged on several different fronts and forwarded advice and information. Specifically, they forwarded this specific criterion right here. Finally, safety is a given. It probably could be placed above and beyond anything. That's a thread that is woven in each and every activity that the department moves into. And the final is leveraging the money. We thought this was extremely important to get the engagement of local government and then to identify additional revenue streams that could enhance these type projects. So leverage of additional funds that would bring benefit to the projects was encouraged. Do a same scan for the preservation projects. We know preservation projects need to be located on district-level highways. We were asked in the bill to define district-level highways. We went through a rulemaking, a temporary rulemaking. We will come December 12th with a final rule, which defined highways. There was little comment on that. It was accepted. It actually comes directly from our highway plan. We've just taken, actually removed some language, just kept the first sentence so that it's clear and concise of what we're talking about. You can see the consistency with the acknowledged and adopted type plans, project readiness, jurisdictional transfer is one of the prioritizing issues. In an effort to encourage those roads that no longer act as state highways but act as a city or county road, jurisdictional transfer was one of those bones that we could throw that would move a project up. Pavement management systems. Here's where we get, and I'll speak to this issue on allocation, but the use of pavement management systems. When we're talking pavement and bridge, the mechanisms that we deemed appropriate to use were our management systems. They are need-based mechanisms that identify the type of projects that need to be fixed. And if our interpretation of the bill was, and like I say, I'll get to this later, but specific, you go to the STIP as the document and the mechanisms for project distribution there. Our STIP is crystal clear on modernization. We have factors that indicate how much money flows to our various regions. Our STIP also dictates that the pavement and the bridge projects are selected through a needs-based mechanism, and that's specific to the pavement preservation projects. That's our pavement management system as the trigger that starts that identification process. Great mobility, safety, and leverage. Finally, we go to the final set of criteria, the bridge. We know that to be eligible, it had to be a load-limited bridge, or it just had to be a state or local bridge. Finally, the issue of project readiness was there again. We go down to the prioritizing factor. There's our needs-based mechanism, the bridge management system. I've skipped over one of these that ripples through. It's project support important community areas where applicable. Just let that read livability type issues. As we were looking for projects specific to pavement preservation, we were looking for those downtown enhancement type projects, those Main Street projects, and I would reference the projects that we have now in Enterprise or in Joseph, where we literally had a paving project. ODOT went in. There were additional revenues identified, and we actually gave the communities facelift. I don't know if you've had the opportunity to get to Joseph, but if you have, you can see the difference of partnerships and finding various revenue streams can truly get a great bang for the buck. That pretty much takes care of the criteria in kind of the bulletized form. In an attempt to help our area commissions and guide them down a path that hopefully offered some clarity to where we were trying to get, the ODOT staff drafted this project, what is Attachment C. It's a project description and guidance. And you'll note on the criteria there are footnotes, and what this document does is help better explain and articulate in a little better detail what we were trying to get at with our criteria. We thought this document would be the guidance for our area commissions on transportation. You see the written word here in a bulletized form. You get a little more detail. It helps chart the course for the conversation. This is just nothing more than a roadmap to help the decision-making process.
Matt, could you comment on the role that the governor's quality development objectives, I think is what they're called, played in the department's working through this? Because I don't see that mentioned.
It wasn't mentioned specifically. It was once again referred to as livability, and actually the QDOs being part of a greater conversation engage with regard to the prioritizing criteria that projects that support important community areas where applicable. applicable. Bottom line, we were looking to those downtown preservation type projects. How do you enhance those type projects? QDOs help direct some conversation in that manner. We took that, we sprung off it, and we went toward the greater livability conversation. We also took a look at leveraging and interpreted that a different way along the governor's Oregon solutions approach. Is there a way, obviously you'll come in and you'll have a transportation fix, but is there a greater conversation with other sister agencies that there may be a transportation fix, but there may be a DEQ water issue here? Is there some connection with Culver's? Look beyond just the transportation fix. Take the lenses off. Try to look at greater opportunity to make sure statewide investment yields the greatest dividend. So that's how we tried to plug the QDOs into the conversation, but wrapped up in the greater livability criterion. If I can continue on, so the second key component that we have dealt with was the criteria. We move on to the allocation of funds. We moved into this conversation with one known, was that we had $400 million. We also knew the tenor of the conversation prior to passage of the bill was an understanding that we would have a split of that $400 million with a roughly half going to modernization and the other half going to preservation, bridge and pavement work. Lengthy conversations, but on August night, our commission affirmed that at least 50% of the monies would go toward preservation projects, and up to $200 million of the proceeds would be targeted at modernization-type projects. We thought that adhered to the conversations prior to bill passage. There didn't seem to be any concern. The commission reaffirmed that. The bill also, once again, when we're speaking allocation, directed us to use the STIP methodology or mechanisms for distributing projects and allocation. And like I mentioned before, modernization was crystal clear to us. What the STIP does is it allows for six factors to be thrown into a formula, those factors being population, vehicle miles traveled, ton miles traveled, total revenue going through the area, and then the modernization needs that had been identified in our highway plan. Throw those into a mix, and we're going to spit out a certain percentage. And that percentage, consistent with our STIP process, showed that related to 2142, that 35% would go to Region 1, and that would represent about $70 million. And as you can see it just ripples out through the various regions. This is consistent with the STIP mechanism and the way modernization monies are allocated. Now, while the STIP does prescribe the distribution for modernization projects, it pretty much assumes distribution for preservation and bridge projects. And what I mean by that is, once again, those projects are selected based on need through our management systems. And those are the mechanisms that we used in identifying the pavement preservation and the bridge project.
Do you want to go through the numbers for each region? I'll just show them
sure.
For the modernization.
Specific to modernization, Region 1 of the Portland metropolitan area received 35% or $70 million of that $200 million for modernization, $70 million. Region 2, the Mid-Willamette Valley area, received $68 million. Region 3, our Southern Oregon area, $28 million. Region 4, this is from John Day from the Dalles to Lakeview, $20 million. And our Eastern Oregon, Region 5, $14 million. Once again, based on those five factors thrown into a formula and spit out. We get to the preservation dollars. Once again, we had at least $200 million for preservation. The commission made the determination after consultation with ODOT staff and the various stakeholders that the $200 million would be distributed in the following manner: $120 million of those dollars going to bridge, $60 million going to pavement, And then they held $20 million in a reserve. And the reason they did that is to once again meet that that mandate that the projects are equitably distributed throughout the state. They thought holding some in reserve ensured that flexibility at the end of the day when they would set back, look at this type of map to make sure that those projects are distributed. They have $20 million to make appropriate fixes to walk away. This is an equitable distribution of the OTA monies.
Do you want to explain the various dots on the map? I think I can read them from here, but I'm not sure everyone else.
I have to give a caveat. I may say a color that doesn't exist. I'm colorblind, but I actually have
the blue dots are for bridge, state and local bridge.
Okay. No.
The orange dots are for pavement preservation, and I believe it's purple are for modernization projects, and that's the spread across. Now, I apologize because you're looking at something that doesn't quite coordinate, and it's just a printer. I promise you,
yeah.
When we printed the policy, the blue, orange, and purple were the same colors to be reflected on that chart.
Yeah, in the last page of the packet, there's a map, committee members.
Attachment G.
Kind of mirrors that they have up there. That gives you something to
get in.
Great.
If you could let us, maybe we could go through the projects and the selection, put that into context, but that is where we are in terms of the recommendations so far from the Area Commission.
Right.
We'll get that. If you just give us a couple more moments, we'll get right to that map.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. The fourth key action is the vetting and the production of the project candidates, and that's what we're seeing here. At our November 8th commission meeting, for the first time our commission saw the universe of projects that can compete. They saw those projects that were above the funding amounts, the dollar amounts, and those below. Once again, the appetite was huge for projects. I don't think that surprises anyone. But to just give you a tenor of the projects that could compete well for OTA money, or they were at least perceived that they can compete very well by the various jurisdictions and ODOT. Specific to just preservation dollars, let's break it down. Specific to bridge dollars. Once again, we have $120 million going toward bridge. We received $727 million worth of project proposals. Specific to pavement preservation, we have $60 million. We received $154 million in proposals. And finally, for modernization, we have $200 million. We received $637 million in requests. So once again, the appetite is huge. As Director Warner indicated, this is a good first step to try to address that huge appetite for transportation infrastructure. Getting to specifics, I'd like to speak now to the draft pavement preservation project list, and that's attachment D in your handout. The preservation projects were submitted in two different categories, the first being district highways that need preservation. 74 projects were identified or submitted. The second category were load-limited highways. ODOT doesn't have very many. I think we have one out in Region 5, and that's a freeze-thaw situation. It's a seasonal situation. But 10 proposals were submitted to the tune of about $14 million, the 140 coming in with the district level, 14. That adds up to roughly the $154 million of appetite. Once again, those were vetted through our ACTS. They ensured that these type projects would meet the criteria. They had robust conversations, and once again, we took these projects. We knew we had $60 million to spend. The ACT said we need a little help. Do you want us to compete as an ACT for the whole $60 million, or can we identify a target which will help us strategically identify the type projects that we want to promote specific to preservation? We thought that was good advice. We came back and we went back to the ODOT regions and gave them ranges for our preservation dollars. What we did for all intensive purposes was take the STIP formula for modernization, tweak it a little bit to better reflect district level highway mileage, vehicle miles traveled and such, and spit out the ranges that you have before you were in Region 1 or Portland metropolitan area, somewhere between $11 and $16 million. Using that kind of tweaked formula, we could arrive at a specific amount. But once again, in deference to having the flexibility and trying to meet our charge to make sure that these projects were equitably distributed throughout the state, we thought ranges actually worked better, and those ranges are reflected in the document. Going to Attachment E, specific to the bridge preservation type projects, I want to spend a little more time on how we arrived at these projects. You know, we have $120 million. The commission has allotted that amount toward bridge. The ODOT and local government have an agreement of how we split our federal bridge dollars right now, and we mirrored that agreement in OTIA. What the agreement says is that 73% of bridge money will go to the state, 27% will go to locals, and that's exactly the split that we have specific to OTIA projects. We did vet this again with the local official advisory committee, and they affirmed that they were comfortable with this split. Once again, the bill itself mandated that we use as a basis for bridge selection a recognized inventory or rating system, an OTC recognized inventory or rating system. Once again, based on need, and that's exactly what we've done. And as we walk through the local bridge and the state bridge, you'll see that was the foundation we used to arrive at the various projects that were submitted. Our local bridge projects came out of our bridge management section. They were reviewed by a local bridge oversight committee for all intents and purposes, made up of state bridge engineers and county bridge engineers. And I think there may be some city folks as well that offer their collective wisdom. We worked through there. There's a split of what we term big bridges. Those are bridges with 30,000 square foot of deck area, and small bridges, those less than that amount. We break those out. Specific percentage of money is allocated toward that big bridge. Toward those small bridges, we mirrored that. In the OTIA case, $7 million was directed toward the local big bridge project. There was only one candidate for big bridges. That was up in Multnomah County. Thus, they were awarded the $7 million for their bridge, or they're a candidate for the $7 million for a specific bridge up there. The small bridges, we looked at the sufficiency rating. When I say sufficiency rating, it actually just identifies the deficit a bridge may have. The higher the number, the worse the bridge, the more vulnerable the bridge is, and that's where the triage goes. So we use that sufficiency rating. We looked at the potential for detour and the impacts on the economy and actually the communities with regard to detours, and then bridge geometry, what's it look like, and then the average daily traffic, how much traffic is actually going over those type bridges. That was the criteria used for the bridges. And we've arrived at the list that you see in Attachment D. The state bridges, we started walking down the same process, but we were dealt a hand that we reacted to. So we tweaked the traditional protocols and processes because of the recent advent of some cracking that's taking place on interstate bridges. There's a bridge design that seemed to be in favor during the late 1940s, early 1960s that ODOT went with. It's now showing some deficits are starting to crack. Now, these are interstate bridges. Because of the economic nature and the encumbrances placed on the movement of freight. And then in one case specifically, this may be becoming an old story, but the issue of livability. We had a bridge go down in southern Oregon, down Canyonville area. What it necessitated on I-5, closing that bridge, detouring those trucks and heavy trucks through the small town of Riddle. At the time before the posting of this I-5 interstate bridge, the town of Riddle would receive maybe 3 trucks a day going through it. At the time of posting the small town of Riddle, we see 1,500 trucks going through it a day. So the impact to the economic bottom line of the state, the livability of the state, we decided to triage our interstate bridges. We knew we had this critical problem that we're looking at, this cracking that's happening on our interstate. That's where we're going to triage the OTIA money. So it's a little bit different than just based on need. We've identified the universe of projects. All these projects on the interstate have deficits. But we narrowed it down right to the interstate, and we've identified that universe of project as the appropriate investment of OTIA money just based on the gravity of if those things go bad quickly. The ripple effect is felt in many different areas. We continue to identify the projects, and once again, here is where the huge deficit comes in. Of the $120 million available for bridges, as I mentioned, we had $727 million of requests that have come in. But even addressing the interstate bridges with our TM money, we still have those critical interstate bridges that aren't dealt with, that are below the cut line. And we'll have to deal with those in the future with some type of strategy. We know it's out there, but OTIA is an appropriate triage. It helps us triage those bridges right now. Moving to the draft modernization projects, which is attachment F. Three categories of projects for all intents and purposes: highways that need increased lane capacity. They made up the majority, actually the bulk, 142 of the 155 projects that were submitted in this category. Interchanges on multi-lane highways received 9 proposals. And then finally, local bridges, new bridges, because new bridges would add capacity, we received 4 of those type proposals, once again totaling about $637 million. Once again, the Act placed these up against the criteria, made sure that all were met, and they forwarded to various candidates that you have in front of you on attachment E. Once again, we've walked through the allocation of mod numbers and the mechanisms that arrived there. So what it does now is it brings us right to the tail end. We're getting very close now as we move to the OTC moves toward its December 12th meeting, and then eventually the January 16th meeting. We now have these universe of projects that have been prioritized, they have been ranked, and there have been cut lines drawn. These are the candidates that you're seeing that spread statewide.
Above the cut line.
These are what we're considering the viable candidates that we can invest and fund with OTIA monies. So coming up in the next couple weeks, our commission will do 2 things. So once they'll receive this cleaned up version of the project list that they received out in Hillsboro last month, they now have been scrubbed and prioritized. Everything's in order. They can look at the way things fall out. They will receive comment. They will receive comment on 2 fronts. ODOT will make comment. Here's what we think about the project. Here are some of the things we're hearing about potential deficits that may be attached to these projects. ODOT will share that with our commission and engage in a back and forth. We will take public comment. The public comment on this process has been extremely healthy and robust. Folks have engaged, and they have shared the pros and cons, and they will continue to share, and I think December 12th will be a linchpin for conversation on projects. Finally, we will speak to the issue of how do you you do still have $20 million held in reserve for preservation-type projects. How are you going to allocate those things? ODOT staff is meeting as we speak, so to identify how do you spend that additional $20 million. That will pretty much take up, for all intents and purposes, the majority of the commission's time on the 12th. What we're intending to do is that conversation is the glide path that will lead us to January 16th, where we expect our commission to make final approval of the projects. And what that will do is that will meet the mandate of selecting projects by February 1, 2002. I thought as an update that would be just a natural closing point for this update, knowing that now we're going to move after January 16th and the projects are selected, we will move to the implementation component of delivering these projects, and I think that would be just a nice foundation to jump off as we come back to the committee at your pleasure. And with that, I'm done, and more than happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you very much for that brief, and I think that's really good information. Gives the committee a good handle on the process that the department has gone through as they've worked to implement this transportation investment. question I have is, part of the criteria is local match and leveraging local dollars. Do you have a number? I mean, $400 million is on the table from the state. What is added to that from local match? Do we have an idea?
I don't know right now, and maybe a little premature. I can assure you that as we move from December to January, we can identify exactly the amounts of dollars that will be leveraged, so to speak. I'm a little reluctant to do it right now because we have the candidates here. There may be some tweaking, but I can assure you that we are leveraging dollars. I don't have that specific amount with me, but as we move toward that January 16th date, I'd feel much more comfortable because we can land specifically on a number because we've identified those projects.
Okay. Other questions from the committee?
Matt, is the engineering at a stage so it's when these projects are finally selected that they can move ahead very quickly and be contracted?
It was a major point in the criteria of project readiness. Now, obviously, you can only go so far until you identify the project that you're going to go, the project selected. But we have tried to position ourselves to take advantage and be ready to identify those projects that would be ready to go. I would say, Representative, that to the greatest extent possible that we could, we have engaged in looking at these projects to try to position so those projects would be delivered in a timely manner. Again, and not to be redundant, but it's extremely important to the agency that we are moving projects, that we're actually having ribbon cuttings, and you're seeing our signs that will be associated with each and every project. This project brought to you by the Oregon Transportation Investment Act. We want a lot of those up. We want that to become a brand people understand. When the word OTIA is mentioned, people know exactly that's the investment that the 2001 legislature made in transportation infrastructure. We want to see a lot of those signs. So we have worked to position ourselves to deliver projects quickly.
Other questions? Representative Berger?
Yes, Matt, where you have in the preservation projects any project that prepares you to make a jurisdictional exchange, will that exchange be made without funds attached? In other words, will it be a clean exchange with no money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, obviously we're looking at that as the quid pro quo for this investment is essentially the local jurisdictions taking over those facilities, and everyone I'm aware of there essentially is here. We're investing this amount of money in the road. In fact, in some cases, we're talking about giving the money to the local jurisdiction first, take over the roadway. Here's the money, do it yourself. And again, be innovative and creative, but essentially the ongoing responsibilities for operation and maintenance after that transfer are the responsibility of local jurisdiction.
Thank you.
Representative Brownhart?
Thank you. And this is really a follow-up on Representative Brown's question. Is what you just said mean that you expect construction to get going on at least some of these projects during the next construction period?
Yes, sir.
Next summer, next spring?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
We have an asterisk on Polk County and Woodburn. What do those mean?
Specifically, which attachment are we looking at?
D, I think.
D? Okay.
With the modernization
project.
Modernization.
Page 7.
Okay.
Page 7.
No,
you're right.
I think you've got the right one, and I don't know, sir, but I will tell you.
Well, I know on the Woodburn one, originally they had the landowners were going to donate the land to do some work, and I think that may have fallen through, and I don't know if that's what that means.
Just to articulate the chart itself, while probably a project with great merit, that is a project that falls below the $68 million allocated to the region. So I know that doesn't answer your specific question. I will follow up as to what that aspect means, but it is not one of those candidate projects collected.
Thank you, Chair.
Matt, I know we're one Oregon and I fully embrace that. The first smaller rural communities, some of these projects represent major development. How does the department ensure that local folks are contracted with whenever feasible? How do we ensure that local vendors are used whenever feasible?
I'll defer to the director.
Nice, Pat. Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, first off, again, we are going to embark on a whole bunch of new strategies to get these projects out to construction very quickly. We're going to be using design-build techniques where we'll be looking at teams of consultants and engineers to essentially do the design and construction concurrently to get these projects underway. We have been working with the consultant community to make sure that we break down our projects in a way that allow them to compete so that some of the smaller consultants in other areas, specifically in your area, can compete for those projects. So when we start talking about design build, we have some flexibility and can actually have some criteria to look at, again, qualifications and, again, taking into account where they reside based on part of that qualification process. For most projects where you do a standard design, bid, and then build, essentially the state law requires us to take the low bid. So there's some limitations there, and we don't have any, so we have some limitations there, but it is our intent to try to spread the work around the state as much as possible. And obviously we're working very closely with the Associated General Contractors to make sure they're aware of this and get their members mobilized to be able to bid on these projects, because I think our intent is to make sure as much of this work gets out as quickly as possible, but also that our folks in the state are the folks who do the work. We can't promise that, I guess, is what I'm telling you.
Sure. Thank you.
Bruce, you or Matt, go ahead.
I just received some information for the representative's honor. The asterisk seems to be a vestige of an old list. It doesn't have any meaning.
No. Oh, okay. Bruce, did you want to talk at all about or further about how we're partnering with local governments to build projects so that we get projects out the door and underway, how the department is working to accomplish that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, committee members, as Matt mentioned, I think we also should have another get-together when your next meeting. Maybe we can give you a real detailed discussion of the implementation steps from once we've selected the projects. But I want to make it clear, I made a commitment to the legislature and to many of you that to deliver these projects, we were not going to be staffing up the Oregon Department of Transportation. We were going to be relying on the private sector, and we're going to be relying on our local government partners to deliver these projects. So we are working with our local government partners, and in many of these projects, especially the ones that are on that list that are local government projects, we're going to be looking to the local governments to deliver those and essentially having fairly simple intergovernmental agreements set up with those jurisdictions where we have enough ability to oversight and make sure that we assure the fiduciary responsibility with the bonds. But the intent is to let those local governments have the dollars, move forward through their own contracting processes to get those on as quickly as possible. I just started to touch on some of the innovative things we're going to do to essentially allow private construction management, design, and ultimately construction as we do in all of our projects, but really to do more of the things that we've just started to do with some of our bridge projects in the last few years. So I'd love to give the committee a much more detailed run-through on some of those things, but you'll see us doing a lot of innovative things and working with both the private sector and our local government folks to move the projects along.
And then I have one further question, and you can comment on it now or later if you'd like, but the whole issue around low interest rate mm-hmm. and the bond amount. Do you wish to comment on that?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I think what your question is obviously we assume $400 million based on the revenues that were generated and the interest rates that were in effect at the time of the legislative session. As a result of the economic downturn, the terrorist attack of September 11th, you know that there's a lot being done to lower interest rates to stimulate the economy. And we're asking ourselves, I've asked my financial staff to say, if with the same amount of revenue, what additional amount of bonding could we support? And in actuality, the $400 million goes to about $467 million that could be supported from the same revenues. So we may have a further conversation about that in terms of flexibility to take advantage of those. And obviously what that means from our perspective is we indicated to you that maybe we would like to sell $100 million worth of bonds for this first biennium. I'm charging my staff to look at, can we double that amount so we can get those monies out and the bonds sold more quickly to take advantage of these low interest rates. But again, there may be some opportunities to even, obviously with legislative approval, to move beyond the $400 million level. So that was your question.
Exactly. Thank you very much. And so, committee members, as we look at a potential special session, there may be an opportunity to bump up the bond limit that we had in 2142 from $400 million to some amount greater than that. But as you see from the information provided us today, there's no shortage of projects out there that interested parties and partners around the state have that they'd like to have built. So, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's sort of a follow-up on that, really. I wonder if the department has considered committing any additional income stream to bonding of a sort as in this act, in addition, given both the low interest rate situation we're facing and the need, and of course the economic situation in Oregon. I'm thinking of partly at least about the possibility of additional economic stimulus for Oregon. Have there been any consideration of additional requests in that area?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, yes, we are looking at that. This is a new way of thinking, obviously, for the department, and the legislature has encouraged us to look at this. The low interest rates clearly make this more effective. I believe after lunch you're going to have a report from a tour of South Carolina where you can talk about some of the things they're doing in essentially bonding of revenues. And clearly when I look at the bridge program, which you're also going to hear about, I look at the amount of money we spend on an annual basis for bridges, and maybe as a result of the bridge issues, you're going to learn a little bit more about maybe we do want to accelerate that. So we're looking at those, and obviously we'll need to come back to you, the legislature, to seek approval of any of those.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much for a very thorough briefing. Appreciate it very much. We next want to hear from some of our other partners in this debate. It's not really a debate, a discussion. Jim Torrey, do you want to come up? Andrea, join him and kind of get the city's perspective as this process has moved forward. And we're starting to get just a little bit behind on our proposed schedule, so.
Good morning.
We'll catch up at some point. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Starr, members of the committee. I'm Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities, and this morning I have with me Mayor Jim Torrey from Eugene. He's also the League's chair of our Transportation Committee, and some of you will have the opportunity to work with him on the Road User Fee Task Force. That I'll turn it over to Mayor Torrey.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Starr and Chair Brown and members of the committee. The League of Oregon Cities does not have a fancy map with colors on it, but there are two key colors on this map, and they're in Lane County and Benton County. There's orange in Benton County and green in Lane County. And I appreciate the fact that the chairs are all green today. Representative Berger, please don't tell your husband I said that. On behalf of the League of Oregon Cities, I want to thank you for the leadership that this committee and the legislature provided to pass this important investment act. At the time the act was passed, I don't think anyone had an idea of how important this would be in terms of an economic stimulus to our state, but it definitely was known with regard to the importance of the need for the infrastructure of our state. Cities are owners of transportation systems, and we understand how critical they are to making industries and business run. We also understand the importance of safety and livability in communities, and you're providing an opportunity with this act to allow those things to happen throughout cities in Oregon. This is an investment in our infrastructure that is truly overdue, and I can't imagine how much courage it took for you folks to step up to this at a time following a defeat of a gas tax that was astronomical in size. But great things happen when people with courage step forward, and I want to compliment you all for that. I've talked about the importance of economic stimulus. I had an opportunity a month ago to be invited back to Washington, D.C. as a representative of the Association of Mayors for the United States. And one of the things we were talking about was security. And then the other thing we were talking about is how do we go about dealing with the economic issues in our state and in the country. And one of the economic programs that the Congress was looking at was infrastructure revitalization. Now, depending on which party you were on, you may not have been as strongly supportive as the other. But what was important to me was they came down to the point that it could not happen quick enough to make a difference in the country. I want to give credit to the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation and his staff for being able to mobilize this project and this investment act in a timely fashion so that it will have an opportunity to have a positive impact on the economies of our state, whether it be cities or counties. Frankly, one of the offshoots of this is that they perhaps ought to take the state of Oregon, its legislature, and its transportation department back to D.C. and show them how it can be done if you do it and if you have an agenda that has a focus point and a timeline that has to be completed to get it done. And I can't compliment enough ODOT for the way they've handled this. There have been challenges. The deadlines have not been easy, but frankly, I believe that sometimes deadlines create good work. Are we going to make a few mistakes? I'll guarantee you we will make a few mistakes. Are we going to do a lot of good things? I will guarantee you we'll get a lot of good things done. I've heard Representative Barnhart ask, will there be something next year? From the beginning, ODOT and the counties and the cities have said there have got to be dirt flying off the side of the roads next year. There will be dirt flying next year. As a side note, I happen to be a mayor of a city that believes that process is the most important thing in the world. You'll note, if you look through all of the projects that are listed here, that Eugene does not have any projects. We have a rule that it takes 25 years to get to an answer. And I want to tell you that yesterday we got to that answer with regard to the West Eugene Parkway, but we don't get any money out of this for that. This timeline for other communities isn't that much of an impediment. And there are projects that are ready, whether it was in Springfield, Oregon, that will be at the intersection of Beltline and I-5 that is a traffic hazard as well as an impediment to the ability to get people from the Medford area to the Portland area, as well as a community like Creswell that is developing now on the east side of the freeway, and the only way across that freeway was a two-lane highway with a very narrow sidewalk. And if you want to get a bicycle and two cars, heaven forbid that you wanted to get a truck over it, you couldn't. And this project is going to provide access for bicycles across that freeway, an enhancement of the sidewalk side. And what I think that is probably most important is the partnerships that have existed in this entire process. The department and the advisory committees that have worked together to make sure that people were taken care of from the standpoint of people in smaller communities in eastern Oregon, when the director came to Klamath Falls and spent literally hours talking to mayors from all over the state of Oregon about what does this mean for me? What does it mean in Brookings? What does it mean in Lakeview? And what does it mean in Enterprise? These folks have been doing their job, and I'm not getting paid to say that about them because there have been a few times when I haven't been that complimentary about ODOT. But I want to say the good things when the good things are happening. League of Oregon Cities have, I believe, done an excellent job. We have disseminated information through the internet, through fax machines, through meetings, and it is hard sometimes to get smaller communities to understand that there is something for them here, because what they typically think is, oh, you know, Portland's going to get it, and Eugene's going to get it, and Medford's going to get it, but there's not going to be anything left for us. And Representative Berger certainly understands the importance of making sure that those roads between California and Coos Bay stay in place over the winter. And when small communities like Bandon or Gold Beach can, in effect, be put out of business if their road base isn't properly maintained, or small communities who have bridges that can go out of place aren't taken care of. And when you see the big cities and the counties saying, wait a minute, let's step back and look at this bridge allocation of $200 million, regardless of where the bridge is, fix the system. If none of it ends up in Lane County, in my particular case, that's okay. Swallow hard, but make the system work. Talking too long here, but this is a critical opportunity for us. You've made it happen. Our challenge is to make sure that we make it happen. I can tell you the partnership is there. The desire to be successful is there. There's a bottom line. We have a lot of projects that are not going to get funded with this $400 million that are very, very important. And we have to show you, and you have to be able to show the people who elect you that this was a good investment. And our goal is to make sure that we do show you that that's happening. Transportation system has to work. There are no two ways about it. And you've helped make it be successful. And I want to thank you all. And I can assure you that we'll be here if you'll call on us, if you need us to come and tell other people in your cities and in your areas of the state how important what you did was to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much for taking the time today.
Thank you.
Judge Pryor, Bill Pinhall. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, we thank you for the opportunity to appear today. It's exciting to come before you and let you know what's happened over the past almost 6 months since you passed the Oregon Transportation Investment Act. Considering the time, I'm going to minimize my comments and provide more time for Judge Pryor. She has driven quite a distance to appear here this morning, and so let me do that. But I did, by way of introduction, of Laura Pryor, the county judge from Gillum County, which is Condon, about 4 hours from here, is that right? Okay. Judge Pryor has been involved in the development of the Investment Act from a number of aspects. Statewide, she chairs the Association of Oregon Counties Transportation Committee, and so she's been involved with the act from that standpoint. She's also a member of the Local Officials Advisory Committee to the Department of Transportation, which has played a very key role in that process. Thirdly, she's the chair of her Area Commission on Transportation, so has had a regional involvement, and as you might guess, is also involved in her own local community as the judge of the county. let me turn the microphone over to Laura. We certainly appreciate the legislature providing this funding source to the state, counties, and cities and providing us the opportunity. It hasn't been easy, but I think you're going to see a result come February and come next January that I think is going to excite all of us. Let me turn it over now to Judge Pryor.
Thank you, Bill. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. It's nice to see you again, members of the committee. Did that introduction scare you to death? It did me. I think that one of the wisest things that you did was put a time frame on this that really kept our robust discussions to a minimum and made us trot quickly down the road. I'd like to tell you just a couple of things about this whole process from the point of view of all those things I'm involved in with transportation. The acts and the time frame and the process that you put in place tried, and with the wisdom of the Department of Transportation, giving us amounts, target amounts, so we knew kind of what we were working with. We weren't just out there in the shooting in the dark and bringing in here $500 million of projects. We tried to, once we got the numbers, we tried to make sure that the projects were all within the money that was available. I think most of the regions, the acts, tried to do that. We also tried to make sure that the projects that we were bringing forward could be done within the timeline. That meant a lot of robust discussion about whether it could be done or whether it couldn't be done. It also brought up some other discussions that I think you need to know about. And one of the questions that was asked here goes to the heart of one of those, and that was, when you're discussing how can you bring projects forward that can be done, one of the big questions that comes forward is, whose regs are we going to have to, construction regs are we going to have to work under to get this done? Are they going to be federal? Are they going to be state? I mean, if you're out in Wheeler County in Antelope, does it make sense to use the regs for the federal government? I would say that ODOT has been exceptional in being willing to say, let's try to figure out how to do that. Let's see if we can figure that out. Instead of, taking the bureaucratic position of, well, that's what it says on page 4, paragraph 3, line 2. There are some other things I think you need to know and you need to think about. Transfer of jurisdiction is only going to happen where the jurisdiction has the money to take it. Leverage is only going to be from jurisdictions that have the money to be able to help leverage. That means either timber reserves or enough population base to get that amount of money together. Small jurisdictions don't have engineers on staff, and they don't have the money to hire them, and they don't have project managers to follow a project. ODOT has been very open and willing to talk about what that really means in terms of how do you get these projects across this state to all different size jurisdictions and try to really get them on the ground. That's not an easy task, but I think that the tools that you've crafted here, and I'm hoping that we're at the beginning of this kind of thing, this new way of looking at how do we fund transportation. I think out of all of this, we should not be deterred when we're running up against some of these things. Get them captured, get them on the board, and let's work that through so that we can be able to deliver these kinds of things over a longer period of time. The one last thing that I would like to say to you is this. I believe that in passing the 190 authority legislation for transportation will allow local jurisdictions, and some of us are already talking about that, to be able, if you do another round of bonding, to be able to bond with you, to be able to really get at, Mr. Chairman, what you were trying to get at, I think, when you were saying to us, can you leverage this? How much money are we bringing to the table as well? I think that's going to allow smaller jurisdictions, smaller counties, smaller cities, to be able to go together collaboratively to do some bonding, to be able to take advantage of this in a way they could not do otherwise. So we're very grateful for that. And I would echo everything that the esteemed mayor said. We're very, very grateful for your taking the risk, and we'll deliver. We'll deliver for you. Thank you.
Great. We're counting on that. Representative Zimmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You drove from Condon this morning. Is it snowing up there? I've driven that highway.
Appreciating
ball games. So
I drove through snow and sleet, and just outside of Cascade Locks and a huge downpour. My windshield wipers got into a fight and killed themselves. So I just... Thank goodness when I got to Portland, there wasn't any rain. So, we had about 6 inches yesterday.
Thank you, Chair. Start, Judge. On the transfer of jurisdiction, you said something that really intrigued me. They have to have the money.
Mm-hmm.
This is my first time on this committee. How is that going to work for our smaller counties, our smaller cities?
Mr. Chairman,
maybe
Representative
this is a
Smith,
question to defer to.
Hold on. No, I think for some of them it's going to be very, very difficult. What we're doing with transfers of jurisdiction, and in many cases I think it's appropriate, but what we're really doing, if you've got 40,000 miles of road in the state, you're just taking one piece and saying, okay, it's still there on the ground, but you're going to be responsible for it. We're just kind of moving it around inside the system. We're not really solving the problems. In some cases, we'll solve ODOT's problems. In some cases, we'll solve a county problem. In some cases, it'll be a city problem. But it's just changed hands. We still have big problems with the whole system. So I do think it's appropriate in many cases, but I think it's going to be very difficult for some folks to do it, and they won't be able to do it.
Right. Well, yeah, and if I could just comment on that, where I'm from in the metro area, what you have is you have state highways that are really serve as local arterial,
mm-hmm.
That are state highways, and because that's what they were when they were first built before all the development happened around them. And so that's from where I'm coming from, mm-hmm. my part of the world. It makes sense to ODOT bring those facilities up to a certain level and then turn them over. And ODOT's making the investment. But you're absolutely right. Cities and counties, they don't have the funds to maintain those. Those aren't as attractive as deals as they are in other areas.
But, Mr. Chairman, the great thing about this is for the first time, I really feel like all of us are talking to each other. I think everybody's listening. And where it won't be appropriate and where you can't do it, I think people will listen. That's a great thing about this.
Right. Mr. Chair, I would just add, it will be a selective process, Representative Smith. Not every district highway mm-hmm. has the characteristics that would suggest it should be transferred to a city or a county. But in those cases, as Representative Starr pointed out, where they are serving as a county or city arterial or collector, then it's probably appropriate to look at those.
That's much clearer for me. Thank
you. Mr. Chair, thank you. It sounds to me, as you talk about the openness of the process, which I appreciate very much, that local land use decisions, local communities' interests, and so forth, are going to be carefully considered in this process. Is that your sense of things at this point?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, absolutely. That is, being chairman of an act, yes, that has been my experience, and from the other people serving that other act, that is what I've heard from them, yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Virgin.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to make a comment about the department, because I believe that the Oregon Department of Transportation is really responsible for the state system, and where they don't have the money to do everything, I think they're very wise to focus on the state system, and where there are roads that are actually used as county roads and used as city roads, local government needs to take the responsibility for some of those. That's just my position on that, because I think we have to be fair to the department, and we can't expect them to be all things to all people.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much
you.
For making the trip over this morning
and
sharing comments with us. Is there anyone else here in the audience that wishes to make a comment regarding the Oregon Transportation Investment Act? Jacob.
Well, thank you, Chair Starr, members of the committee. Be really brief. 1,000 Friends of Oregon, I'm the transportation advocate for 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and we've been gratified to see several features in the implementation of House Bill 2142, including the adoption and application of rigorous criteria that require projects to meet existing Oregon Transportation Commission and ODOT policy. In addition, I think the size of the allocation means that the readiness criteria and the vetting of a larger number of smaller projects that kind of meet targeted specific transportation needs. So a positive feature of moving forward with this bill. And I want to speak real briefly to a couple of the kind of bumps we've seen along the way. I think that this process has been an interesting process for testing out the extent to which public involvement in transportation decision making is working and is not working. We've seen a couple of kind of problems along the way. Several acts didn't have project proposals ready in time for the public to review before hearings, that sort of thing. So there have been some kind of roadblocks to meaningful public involvement in this process. And as I've watched that, I've been apprising the Oregon Transportation Commission, but I wanted to share that with the House Transportation Committee as well. But I think that, again, I'm confident that the department and the other stakeholders are learning from this process, and that it's going to lead to kind of a more inclusive process next time around. And I'm looking forward to seeing the commission apply the criteria and ensure that the projects that are being proposed for funding meet those criteria at the December 12th hearing. And we're currently in the process of analyzing the projects. We got the list of projects rather late. I'm in the process of analyzing those and making our recommendations to the Transportation Commission. I'd be happy to send a copy of that to the committee if the committee is interested.
Okay.
So thank you.
Other questions for Jacob?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, that will conclude our informational meeting on House Bill 2142. It's been my hope, my desire that that this would be the first step in a long road to deal with the transportation needs in this state, an opportunity for the various stakeholders and partners in the system to redevelop relationships, renew trust that has not been there in recent history. And I think, as I've watched the process, that I'm optimistic that all of those things that I've desired are going to come about. And I'm excited, actually, as I've watched the process. So I want to say thank you to the department for the work they're doing and going to continue to do, and look forward to great things in the future. With that, we want to move along down our agenda this morning. We've got next on the agenda the I-5 Partnership Bi-State Task Force Report. Kate Dean is here, and I had Dave Williams on my list. Is Dave not going to join us?
Dave is not with me.
Okay.
I'm solo.
Great. Well, that's perfect. I think we're going to get an overhead set up here, so we got a moment to get that set up, and then you can proceed.
It's okay over there. That's great. Chair Starr, Chair Brown, my name is Kate Dean. I work for the Oregon Department of Transportation up in the Portland area, and I am managing a project called the I-5 Partnership. The full name actually is the Portland-Vancouver I-5 Transportation and Trade Partnership, but that's kind of a mouthful, so we try to shorten it up. I'm going to be speaking mostly off of the attachment to the materials that you just received, and starting on the second page, I will try to be brief, and if you want me to be quicker, just let me know. If you don't want to see all the maps that I have, we can shorten things up significantly. The I-5 Partnership is a bi-state planning project that is sponsored by the Oregon and Washington Departments of Transportation in cooperation with the Federal Highway Administration. We are led by a 28-member bi-state task force that was appointed by the two governors, Governor Locke and Governor Kitzhaber. And the purpose of the work that we're doing is to take a look at the I-5 corridor between Portland and Vancouver, and to develop a strategic plan for that corridor to address the bottlenecks basically on the freeway so that freight and people can travel freely. And you see on that very first page the limits of the corridor, which basically go from the I-84 interchange down in the Rose Quarter area up through North Portland, across the Columbia River into Vancouver, and where up it ends right where I-5 and I-205 meet. That's about a 14-mile corridor. The members of the task force are the next page in your handout, and as you look over those names, you might note that it's really a public-private task force that includes elected officials, including the two mayors of Portland and Vancouver. It includes other elected officials. It includes business community members. It includes neighborhood folks and community representatives. So we've really tried to be fairly broad-based in the composition of the task force. And their charge is to make recommendations, to really look at this corridor and to make recommendations to the two transportation commissions, one in Oregon, obviously, and one in Washington, and to our regional decision makers about what should be happening in the I-5 corridor to manage and improve that for the future. We got started on this study with some previous work that had been done in the corridor. We had some business folks that came together on both sides of the river to take a look at the corridor and advise us about really what we should be doing. How bad is the problem in the corridor, and does it really warrant the resources of the state to continue to plan for this corridor and potentially to improve it? And really what they found, they had four key findings. Number one, that this is one of the most economically important corridors in the state. And I'll, as we go over some of these maps, I think I can demonstrate that to you more visually. So hold on to that thought for a minute. That doing nothing really threatens the economic promise and livability of not only the region, but of the state. That there, unfortunately, is no silver bullet, that highways alone won't address the issues in the corridor. Transit alone won't address the issues in the corridor. We can't manage our way out of the problems there, but it really needs to be a multimodal kind of solution. There need to be a lot of tools in the toolbox for this corridor because it is quite complex. And finally, they took a look around at the state, both Oregon and Washington's state of transportation finance. They acknowledge that we're not, there aren't deep pockets here. There aren't really deep pockets at the federal government level either, and that it really will take some measure of self-help and innovative financing in order to fund some of these projects. And so issues such as tolling the bridges or tolling in order to pay for some of these new improvements are some of the things that they have suggested should be looked at in the course of considering how to finance improvements in the corridor. So we are now at the point of developing this multimodal plan with the task force, again, not only looking at the freeway, but also looking at transit service in the corridor, how do we manage demand, and what are the needs of the freight and rail, the freight and passenger rail system. The task force got started in January. They spent about January last year, so they've been going for about a year. They spent about 6 months talking to one another, holding meetings with the public, and really trying to determine what kinds of options should be considered in this corridor. In June, they adopted six alternatives for study over the summer, and we, as staff and our consultant team, spent the summer looking at what are the benefits, what are the impacts, and what are the costs of those six options. And this fall, we presented that information to the task force and to the public. And as you'll see in a minute, we're getting ready to begin doing decision making now that they've got all of that information. If you'd like, I'd like to go over just really quickly to give you an idea of the six options that we've considered. You feel you have time to do that? I'll try to go over them quickly and save us some time.
So the first option that you see up here is something that we call base travel, just to orient you. This is the road corridor area. This is I-5 right here. This is I-84. And so the study really starts right here, and it goes north across the Columbia River into Vancouver. We looked at what would happen in the corridor over the next 20 years if we just look at our regional plans, both in Oregon and Washington, about transportation projects in this corridor that we already planned to build. And so some of those things are already there. We obviously have a light rail line on the Dan Field, and we just established the airport mass line recently was open. Right now, under construction is another light rail line on Interstate Avenue, parallel to I-5, that will eventually terminate right here, which is at about the Expo Center. On the road end of things, we have a two-lane bottleneck here, right down by the road quarter. We also have another two-lane bottleneck right here between Delta Park and Lombard. Recently on the Washington side, this section was formerly two lanes, just a couple of, maybe a month ago, that opened up to be three lanes. And this section from 99 to 205 is imminent. It's in their next six-year plan, so that has funding and is expected to proceed. So these are what we call the baseline projects, and again, this is what we already have in our 10-year time frame. Let me just take a minute to hit back on that, the economic significance of this quarter, just so we get folks oriented. And most of you probably already know this, but just to hit this home a little bit more. This is the Columbia River. And right in here on the Oregon side is really located much of our industrial land. We have many of the Port of Portland terminals are over here. This is the Portland Airport. And this, what we call the Columbia Corridor, contains much of our industrial land base, and businesses are located there. In addition, we have, throughout this corridor, we have many rail facilities. This is the Albina District. We have the Northwest Industrial District over here. We have Swan Island. So you can see that there is really a lot here from an economic standpoint. Over in Vancouver, Vancouver is located right over in this vicinity, and all of this land, much of this, is dedicated to industrial uses. So, in addition, we do have a very good freight rail system, both south-north and east-west. Those are transcontinental rail lines that really provide access all the way across the country, both north and south, east and west. I'm going to flip through these fairly quickly now with that base established. So what you're going to see is baseline projects are going to begin showing up in each of the subsequent options that we looked at. We looked at two options that basically test or made freeway, three lanes in each direction. Right now it's three lanes for the most part, except for those two bottlenecks at Delta Park and down by the Rose Quarter that I explained. So it's basically three lanes throughout the corridor. And the key feature of this option, which we call three lanes and express bus, is it does provide a new river crossing here in the Columbia River, and I'll come back to that in a minute. From a transit end of things, it provides a transit connection, express bus in high occupancy vehicle lane, HOV lane, from the intersection of I-5 and 205, now down to the Expo Center where the Interstate Avenue light rail line is located. So passengers traveling in that corridor from a transit perspective would get on the bus somewhere in this corridor, zoom down here, transfer to light rail line, and continue down into this part of the Portland area and on their reverse home commute.
I hate to do this, but we need to have
you're
you
not
on.
Picking me up?
Yeah.
Should I sit down?
Yeah.
I apologize. Someone else maybe can give your.
Okay. So the other, the green lines over on I-205 and SR-500 and SR-14 also indicate express bus service. Those are express bus lines that would run in general purpose traffic, not in an HOV lane. The HOV lane, high occupancy vehicle lane, is only open during the peak period in the peak direction. Let me just comment about the bridge that you see there. One of the problems with the bridge is that while it's three lanes in each direction, if you know, wherever to cross it, and it's a big bottleneck. And if you were to cross it and look at it, you'd say, it looks like three lanes to me. What's the problem here? And the problem really is that you've got interchanges right on either side of that bridge that are smack dab on top of it. And so the Hayden Island Interchange and the SR 14 Interchange, really what happens is everybody who travels this corridor on a regular basis gets over in the left-hand two lanes because they know that right-hand outside lane really is used to let people come on and off the freeway. So it acts more as an auxiliary lane. This turns out to be a very significant bottleneck, and fixing this is really when you see a lot of improvement in how the freeway system operates. Let's go on to the next one, because it's important to know that, because a bridge is a key feature of every one of these options. So not dwelling on this too long, this again is, again, a three-lane configuration with a new bridge. And from a transit standpoint, this is a light rail loop system in Clark County that would connect up with the Oregon system. It would go basically from the interstate light rail terminus at Expo, across the Columbia River into downtown Vancouver, crossing over east-west in the vicinity of SR 500, and then continuing down on 205 and connecting up with the Interstate Max Airport Max light rail line.
And that would include a new bridge across the river for the light rail.
Yes, and it will probably, well, we're discussing whether it's going to be a joint-use bridge for vehicles in transit or whether you build two new bridges. That's still up for discussion, but the idea is, yes, you have both transit and vehicle capacity being provided across the Columbia River in the I-5 corridor. This one is really same as that three-lane with express bus, except what we're studying here is what happens if you add another lane to the freeway in each direction between I-84 in Portland and 205 in Washington, so 14 miles of a new lane in each direction. That makes the freeway be four lanes in each direction. This particular option was modeled and studied as an HOV lane in the peak period, peak direction. And this particular option also would have express bus instead of terminating at Expo. The express bus system would run all the way down to downtown. So there would be no transfer to the interstate light rail line. There also would be express bus service then on 205 and on SR 14 and SR 500 in general purpose lanes. Again, here's another four-lane scenario. Again, it includes a bridge, and this is that light rail loop system that I discussed earlier. So it's four lanes in each direction and a light rail loop system. This is the our one area of innovation. this is a project that's parallel to the I-5 corridor, but not directly in the I-5 corridor. We call this the West Arterial Road, and it's a four-lane facility, two lanes in each direction, that would basically begin over here in Vancouver, cross the Columbia River, and terminate over here in Portland at US 30. It would also touch down at Hayden Island, Columbia Boulevard, Marine Drive. And the good thing about this from an Oregon perspective is we've got a lot of problems here in the St. John's area with truck traffic. Solves that problem really well. The bummer thing about this is over here in Vancouver, there's not really a good way to get that traffic from the place where it ends back over to the freeway, which is really where people want to go. Without really being quite disruptive to the neighborhoods and to downtown. So we haven't really licked that problem about how would you connect this road up. And finally, we are studying the freight rail system. It's really on a separate timeline from the highway and transit work that we're doing, and we'll have that available this spring. We're looking at the needs of the freight rail system. And as we do that, we will be looking at an option that would have commuter rail that would run basically in new tracks from somewhere in the vicinity of downtown or perhaps the Rose Garden area up through North Portland, continuing up to Woodland and Richfield and east and west out to Camas. It's hard to make it sitting down here at this angle. So those are the options that we have looked at. Let me just finish up by telling you what the next steps are. As I mentioned, all of the data is in, and Janet can attest to the fact that it can be a little overwhelming to try to comprehend it. But we have recently had two very successful public meetings attended by over 300 people, one in Vancouver, one in Portland, where we reviewed with them the benefit, cost, and impact information, reviewed with them some of the conceptual designs that we've been looking at. The task force also recently received this information. In December, the task force is expected to develop working draft recommendations for public review. In January, there will be another round of public involvement. At the end of January, they are expected to adopt working draft recommendations, and that will really center on the highway and transit elements of things. Over the next 6 months, is really when we will begin to add in other features of the strategic plan. How do you finance these things? What are the needs on the both the freight and the passenger rail system? How do we better manage demand? How will we use HOV in this corridor? Are there better ways for us to do ramp meter timing, other kinds of technological solutions? And finally, are there things that we can do from a land use policy standpoint that preserves the capacity that we have on the road without making and doesn't diminish the investments that we're making on the road? For instance, at there's a possibility of doing development at Hayden Island or at a Hayden Meadows up in North Portland. And to the extent that that gets developed as commercial land, you really attract a lot more trips. The extent that gets developed as industrial land, you'll have less trip generation. You preserve that capacity for freight. You preserve the capacity and the investment that you've made without significantly increasing the number of trips on the road. So we are looking at issues such as that about how do we best manage and preserve the capacity that we have. It would be great if we could entertain any questions that you have. I know you're running short of time. I think we'd appreciate the opportunity to come back and share with you as the recommendations get developed. At a minimum, let you know by letter what those recommendations are in January, and continue to be sharing these things with you, because clearly these are very big improvements that are being considered. They will very likely need to consider the use of innovative financing and possibly tolls. We're likely to need bi-state legislative authority if we do anything on a bridge, and so we'll want to keep you apprised of the process and how things are going.
Thank you very much. Question I had is, as I looked at the task force members, and I recognize that the governor's put these together, there's not legislative involvement, either in the state of Oregon or Washington.
Right. When we, it really was a matter of timing. When we started this was when you guys were in the midst of the session last year, and knowing that we were meeting month by month, we just, I guess, made a judgment call, not an oversight, but a judgment call that it would be difficult to have that legislative involvement fairly consistently. But we do, I really would encourage you, to the extent that you've got strong feelings about this, to, come to some of the meetings. If you let me know that you want to come talk, we can make accommodations for that.
And estimated costs?
Oh, estimated costs. They range basically from, there's a wide range. And on the low end of things, if you just do the baseline improvements, that's probably around $300 million, about $250 for that Rose Garden improvement. The Delta Park improvement is much smaller. It's about $40 million in today's dollars. When you get up to doing four lanes and a light rail system, we're talking billions, so a couple billion dollars. Or a system that would have those two things. So you can see that There's not a lot of way that we could, you know, we've done the assessment that the money isn't here in the state. It's not in Washington. We're probably, while there's a great federal interest here and we want to get all the federal funding we can, should we get to a build decision, and we'll be very aggressive about that, that their pockets are not as deep as they once were. And again, just reinforcing that we're going to have to figure out a different way to really make up that difference.
And one final question from me, and I don't know if the committee has any, but as we sit up here, I'm the only legislator on this panel from the metro area.
Mm-hmm.
Why should legislators that represent the Oregon coast or eastern Oregon or down the valley, why should they care about what happens on I-5 between Vancouver and Portland?
Yeah. Thanks very much for giving me that softball. I appreciate that.